The 2003 Sunstone Symposium West, held in San Francisco on April 19th, presents session number 41, Will the Real Lamanites Please Stand Up? By Armin L. Moss, with a response by Thomas W. Murphy.
It tells me about it. I've heard Armin talk before, and he has dealt, at least in previous discussions, about extensively with what I call one of the sacred cows of Mormonism, this idea about we're all part of the house of Israel and we're literal descendants and there's blood flowing, and there's even some statements that at least one of my ancestors claims to have had been direct descendant of Jesus Christ. I mean, that sort of, and I don't know what extent he deals with all that in the book, but just the general idea. And he will speak to us first, and I presume I would give him license to sell his book, but also to sort of to talk to us generally what the issues are in the book and how he feels about them. After he has spoken, Tom Murphy will respond, and Tom is, I sense, one of the upcoming replacements for Armin. Armin has been around a long time and is, by his own choice, is taking a less active role in these kind of happenings in Mormonism, and Tom has sort of stuck his neck out in some areas similar to that and has been maybe moving up on the scale with us. But we're fortunate to have both of them, and then following, they both assured me they don't plan to speak very long. I will believe that when I see it, but anyway, they do guarantee they'll leave us some time for questions. So, Armin.
The ostensible focus of my remarks today is capsulized in the question, will the real Lamanites please stand up? That suggests accurately that I want to focus my remarks mainly on the question of who today's Lamanites are and how they came to be Lamanites. But it's important to understand that question is embedded within the larger context that provides the subtitle to my new book, which is Changing Mormon Conceptions of Race and Lineage. I began by studying what we have since come to call the black issue, and I began that quest some 40 years ago to try to figure out how in the world we got where we were in the 1960s in our teachings and practices relating to blacks. But as I went on, I'm kind of a slow learner, so it was kind of gradual, but it gradually dawned on me that whatever we were doing with regard to our policies and doctrines about blacks was part of this larger context of an LDS framework based on a belief in a divinely instituted hierarchy of lineages. And I don't think that we can get much understanding about the history of our relations with black people unless we understand that it is part of that context. The context was a long time in developing, and I kind of studied segments of it in reverse chronological order to that in which the concepts developed. The first thing to develop was actually the concept that we had as Latter-day Saints, white Latter-day Saints, white Anglo-Saxon Latter-day Saints, about our own lineage and our own identity. That was the first thing to develop. And the attitudes and teachings and ideas about blacks was really much later to develop. And so while I got initially interested in this by looking at the black situation, I finally came to understand that where it all began was back in with Joseph Smith himself, and that the beginning of all of this has to be traced to Joseph Smith's identification of himself in a passage in 2 Nephi, which speaks of Joseph's being a descendant of the original Joseph, the ancient patriarch. And it's not clear to me that when Joseph Smith first encountered that passage, however it appeared on the page, it's not clear to me that Joseph immediately understood that meant that he and all of his family were descendants of Joseph, who was sold into Egypt. But at least the prophet Joseph early on came to understand himself as having this literal descent, and that this was part and parcel of the reason that he was called to be a prophet to the new dispensation, and in particular why he was called as a descendant of Joseph. He quickly understood to take the restored gospel to the other descendants of Joseph, those who came not through Ephraim, the son of Joseph, but through Manasseh, the son of Joseph, which were the people living on the western side of the Mississippi River. So the initial understanding of the prophet Joseph was that he was called in large part, and eventually he came to see himself as foreordained in large part as part of his direct ancestry back to the patriarch Joseph. That idea gradually developed over the next decade to during the 1830s, until by the end of that decade or into the 1840s, there was a general understanding among the prophet and his colleagues that they were all descendants of Joseph, and in fact that they were descendants in particular of Ephraim. And it made a certain amount of sense, because basically the first 100 members of the church were all related. I mean, they were all cousins and sometimes in-laws, but so it was a very, very much a family thing when it started. I won't stop now to go into the question of how the practice of patriarchal blessings fits into this. I cover that at some length in the book, and how the understanding of lineage in patriarchal blessings has actually changed with the passage of time. But it was that practice, too, initially was very much part of this definition of the early white Latter-day Saints, Anglo-Latter-day Saints, as literal descendants of Ephraim. And I go into the question of how the intellectual currents coming across the Atlantic from England in particular, and even from continental Europe, influenced this development within Mormonism of the idea that white Anglo-Saxon Mormons were literal descendants of Ephraim. The Anglo-Saxon part was important, and the Ephraim part was important, and they were put together gradually in the development of these ideas in early Mormonism. I have a lot of quotations that demonstrate this. What I think really locked it into place was the experience that the early LDS missionaries had when they went to England, and literally almost hordes of converts that joined the church out of England, providing all the reinforcement that anybody needed of the idea that the British Isles were full of Israelites, particularly Ephraimites, just waiting for the gospel. And so, not surprisingly, when patriarchal blessings were actually given to this first generation of Mormons, they almost all referred to them as descendants of Ephraim. And so that's a big story that is chapter 2 of the book. So I'll let you read that for yourself. Chapter 1 is more general and theoretical, but chapter 2 is the one that goes into this, what I call the quest or search for Ephraim. Now, was contemporaneously, really, with that development, or following shortly on that development, was the identification of the North American Aboriginal peoples as Lamanites and descendants and through their paternal line of Manasseh, through their maternal line from Ephraim. The Doctrine and Covenants in a couple of sections is explicit that the city of Zion is to be located on the borders by the Lamanites. And so when the city of Zion was established in western Missouri, it was indeed on the borders by the Lamanites. And these Lamanites, incidentally, had all very recently been moved there by fiat of the federal government. Especially Andrew Jackson had the idea that all the eastern side of the Mississippi should sort of be cleaned out, ethnic cleansing, and they should all be moved over to the new territory opened up by the Louisiana Purchase, where they'd kind of be out of the way and wouldn't do any harm. Well, of course, the prophet and his early colleagues saw this as a divine intervention. What could be more wonderful than to have this whole bunch of people who would just be waiting for the prophet to bring them their history, than to have them sitting right there on the border next to Zion? So the very first missionary expedition sent out was sent out to the Indians. Now, it never really got very far, because the first thing they encountered was Kirtland and Sidney Rigdon. And so an unintended consequence of the first missionary expedition to the Indians was the conversion of a whole bunch of Campbellites in Kirtland, Ohio. But they did go on, those first four missionaries did go on to Indian country and had some early conversations and encounters, enough to encourage them that that here were indeed some people who were waiting for the gospel to be brought to them. So this idea that the Lamanites are the North American Aboriginal peoples really goes back to the very beginnings of Mormonism. And I acknowledge in the book, as anybody would have to, that this was not an original idea with Joseph Smith. That is, the idea that the Native American peoples were ultimately lost Israelites. That was a idea that had been around for a long time, maybe as much as 200 years. But the specific focus on these people next to Missouri as the Lamanites, particularly as not only as lost Israelites, but particularly as a special group of lost Israelites called Lamanites. That idea was a original with Joseph Smith, and provided the basis for his wholehearted belief and assumption that all they had to do was to be exposed to the message of the Book of Mormon, and they would join the church just in great droves. Well, there was more interaction between Mormons and Indians than a lot of people realize in that early period. It was mainly the visit of during the Nauvoo days, visit of various prominent Indians from local tribes coming to consult with Joseph Smith, that helped again to encourage this idea that there was a relationship here that could really be developed. The various Indian tribes had their own agenda, of course. They were looking for allies against the U.S. government. And so they had a lot of reasons for trying to cultivate the Mormons, and the Mormons had their reasons for wanting to cultivate the Indians. And that's another whole long story. A lot of people have written about that who are more knowledgeable than I am. After the Nauvoo period, under leadership of Brigham Young, there isn't a great deal that happens in relations with Indians until the Saints get to Utah. Brigham Young, in fact, was very wary about any kind of entanglements with the Indians crossing the plains. They were regarded with some wariness because there had been some celebrated cases of other white settlers crossing, or emigrants crossing those plains and having bad times with the Indians. Brigham Young had a strategy for dealing with them that was in large part hands-off, kind of arm's length strategy, while trying to retain basically friendly relationships. So it's when you get to Utah that you find really the first serious effort to convert Indians. And I'll sum up about 50 years of history in Utah with the Indians by saying that roughly every decade, a church leader would stand up in General Conference and say, "We've got to do something about all of these Lamanites in our midst. There they sit, just waiting to be converted, and what are we doing about it? Not much. We've got to get out and do this." So everybody would get all excited and enthused, and people would be called to go out to southern Utah, Arizona, or even over into Nevada and start working with the local tribes. Then you wouldn't hear much about it for a while, and in another 10 years, there would be another campaign to go out and do the same thing. And every time after the first campaign, why, the pulpit rhetoric included the statement that we've got to stop just baptizing these people and letting them run wild, which was a way of conceding that there wasn't much retention going on. They would have sometimes mass baptisms, and then, you know, a few months later you couldn't find any of them anymore. And they were migratory people anyway. They went, you know, back and forth depending on where their food staples could be found. So, to make a long story short, almost every decade there was a campaign through the 19th century to convert Indians, and they all turned out eventually about the same way, which is to say, darn few converts that you could find by the end of the century. And it's clear that by the end of the century, the church leaders were really quite discouraged about the prospects. And anyway, again, much of this has to be understood in the context of national government policy. Anyway, during this time was also the time when most of the Indians, by about 1870 already, had been put on reservations and were kind of out of circulation and not often seen by white settlers, except those settlers that happened to live very near Indian villages. it's sort of a sad story as you read about the sincere efforts by these dedicated people to convert Indians, and how little they have to show for it after decades of effort. So partly because the Indians were on reservations and the rest of the nation was moving on, and partly because the church itself was starting to have all kinds of other problems starting in the 1880s. Can anybody think of what some of them might have been? The focus turned away from Indians almost totally, both in the church and in the nation, so that from the 1880s sometime all the way to the 1940s, there was virtually nothing done by way of relationships with the Indians. And it was as though, one way I've put it in the book, it's as though the Lamanites had faded back into the pages of the Book of Mormon, where they were, you know, safe, and really not dealt with again until in the 1940s, a new campaign was launched by a whole new generation of church leaders. The first energetic leader in this, surprisingly, was George Albert Smith, who, as president of the Quorum of the Twelve in 1943, announced the opening of a new mission and Southwest Indian, I think it was called, and the effort to start again missionary work among the Indians. It was also in 43 or 44, however, that Spencer Kimball was called as an apostle. And, of course, he picked up the ball very quickly because President Smith, President Smith lived till 1951, became president in 45, and then lived till 51. It wasn't a long tenure. But President Kimball, of course, lived much longer than that. Anyway, we need, at least in passing, to give credit to President George Albert Smith, because he really sincerely felt this need to return again to the Lamanite cause. But it was President Kimball who's well known among even all of us for his half century of devotion, or several decades of devotion at least, to the Indian cause. And so the phrase so commonly used was the Day of the Lamanite. The Day of the Lamanite was the day brought by the Prophet Joseph in the Book of Mormon. And that day never quite fully dawned. So the Day of the Lamanite was announced again in the 1940s. And enormous efforts were made all throughout the second half of the 20th century, all the way up to about 1990, to convert Indians. And this was the period, under the leadership of President Kimball and a number of others who joined in this effort, this was the time that we had the placement program for high school kids, or even grade school kids, and when we had Indian seminaries as special things. A lot of Indian kids were sent by the federal government to Indian boarding schools, like the one in Brigham City. And so the first effort that happened really was to set up seminary for them on campus. And then there were some off-campus seminaries for Indians as well. And then came the placement program. And then beginning in the 1960s, in particular late 50s, early 60s, an enormous and growing campaign to bring Indian students to BYU on full ride scholarships. And there were hundreds over the next few decades that came to BYU as students, with their tuition paid for initially totally by the church. As time went on and other agencies began picking up the tab for Indian education, like the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the scholarships at BYU were subsidized and supported by some of those other sources, but it was BYU's initiative and initially BYU's scholarship money that brought those kids to BYU. Kind of a pipeline developed in which the Indian kids would start off with Indian seminaries while they were still in junior high age or younger. Then they would go into placement in white LDS homes in the student placement program, and then from there to BYU. I don't want to leave the impression that was the only path, because they could actually come into this pipeline, if that's what it was, at any of those stages. But it was typical for people to follow that general sequence. And so by the time the 1980s come, we have hundreds and hundreds of college graduates out of BYU, many of whom went on to very important positions in the Indian tribal government, and even outside of that into mainstream white society. Then something happened. The good old LDS prophets and apostles, among their other attributes and strengths, is that they are very strongly pragmatic. Somebody suggested that we ought to do some kind of cost-benefit study to see what is happening with all of these Indians. And the cost-benefit study produced the rather unhappy discovery that while the Indian products of this church pipeline, as I've called it, were by and large greatly benefited in secular matters, that they had not changed much religiously in their religious behavior. That is to say, they were not staying with the church at the rate that it was expected they would. And in particular, they were not fulfilling the dream of the early brethren at this time, especially President Kimball, that they would, having been converted and well-educated, would now take the gospel to their fellow Indians in other parts of the hemisphere. The brethren had the understanding at that time that, pretty much Lamanites were Lamanites and Indians were Indians. So if they were converts, then there should be a natural bond between the converts made in the West and the Indians anywhere else in the hemisphere. So the hope was that if they joined the church and had all the benefits of all this background, help from the church and BYU, they'd all go on missions to Mexico and to Latin America and convert all the Lamanites down there. That was the hope. But as the leaders began to survey what was happening to all these hundreds of Indian converts and college graduates, it was discovered that a lot of them couldn't be found anymore. And those who could, in large numbers, had gone back to live life on the reservation. And this meant a number of things that were very non-Mormon things to do, like drinking, marriage, not in the temple, but according to either tribal customs or even something a lot less formal than any kind of marriage ceremony. And this was very troubling. So a decision was made by the agency responsible for the Indians, which was called by various names like the Lamanite Committee and had other names as well. It was led by two or three apostles. A decision was made by the Indian Committee that all these programs for Native Americans would be phased out, and attention would be focused directly on Mexico and Latin America instead. So that's basically what happened. And I quote in my book this wonderful talk that Elder Boyd K. Packer gave in 1979. Every February for years on BYU, they had Indian Week. And during Indian Week, in February of 1979, Elder Packer went down and addressed an assembly of Native American students that were there at BYU. And he said a number of things. And I'm paraphrasing, but it was just about this explicit, even though it was couched in softer language. But the message was unmistakable. Look at what the church has done for all you kids. And what have you done for the church? You get your BYU degrees and you go out and become successful, and that's all great. But that's not what the church program is about. The church program is not about making people successful in terms of the world. It's about changing people's lives. It's about spiritual growth and development. And so what has the church got to show for all of these decades of effort? You know, you don't go on missions like you're supposed to, very few of you. You don't get married in the temple. You don't accept positions in the church. You know, when you're called, you're reluctant to become bishops or anything like that. So we're not going to do this anymore. That there are lots of other Lamanites further south, and they've been joining the church in huge numbers. So from now on, we're going to take our effort and our money down where it matters. And that was the unmistakable message in 1979. And you can see the whole Indian program just gradually fold into nothingness from that point on. In the book, I trace this kind of anguished process in which, you know, the BYU faculty that was devoted to these Indian programs was really committed to those programs and really believed in them. And they faced this uncomfortable position where the church leadership through the BYU administration was telling them that, you know, this is it. It's over. And they had to be reassigned to other departments. And some of them, you know, were heartbroken and left for other jobs somewhere else. It was a very difficult time for the faculty people themselves. And so since then, the focus of the church has been in Latin America. And thereby hangs another tale, which I'll be very brief about because we do want to leave time for input from the audience. Back about the time that that is to say in the middle of the 20th century, as the church was becoming more interested in launching a new day of the Lamanites, Department of Archaeology was established at BYU, and a number of two or three anyway folks in that department decided that one of the great things that they could do would be to go to Latin America and find the city of Zarahemla and other kinds of proofs, archaeological proofs, of the authenticity of the Book of Mormon. And that didn't get too terribly far. Nobody ever really found much archaeological evidence. And meanwhile, however, Hugh Nibley was starting his career and never did believe much in archaeology. His idea was that if you want proofs of the Book of Mormon, you look inside the book. That's where you're going to find all the proofs you need, and especially in the parallels that he saw between what the Book of Mormon said and what he knew of of Semitic or Middle Eastern cultures. So Nibley did his work, and you got to be an old man like me to remember when we had lessons in priesthood that had some substance, and and Exhibit A was Nibley's Lehi in the Desert, World of the Jaredites, and even if it was tendentious, that is to say, you would expect it to be biased in favor of the authenticity of the Book of Mormon, still it was substance, and you learned a lot of stuff. And so Nibley was beginning his career. He went on to continue in that line of development. And one of Nibley's converts, of course, was John Welch, who lived in Southern California in the 70s, well, 60s and 70s. And in about 1979 or 80, Welch joined the law school at BYU and brought with him a fledgling organization that had started while he was in California. It came to be known as FARMS, Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies. FARMS immediately picked up where Hugh Nibley had been going and has really been developing the case for the authenticity of the Book of Mormon as revealed through literary and historical parallels that you can find in the Book of Mormon itself, parallels between the book and what we know of other ancient peoples and scriptures. All of you have, I'm sure, in your experience in the church, come across in one form or another Welch's argument about chiasmus as a rhetorical or poetic structural type in the Book of Mormon. And he's gone on from there and the FARMS people to develop things a lot further than that. FARMS existed for a long time as an organization fully independent of the church and BYU, even though it was based in Provo. But about 3 years ago, it was brought under the BYU administration. So that's good news and bad news. The good news is they have access to all BYU's resources. And the bad news is that they face the correlation movement. So what I have found fascinating in all of this is what all of this has meant for the way in which Latter-day Saints identify Lamanites. Who are the Lamanites? Now, one of the things that's happened at FARMS, primarily under the influence of John Sorensen's book in 1984, I think, five, his book, Ancient America as a Setting for the Book of Mormon. Led by Sorensen, the FARMS literature has almost without exception taken the position that the whole Book of Mormon story took place within a radius of a few hundred miles in southern Mexico and Guatemala. The so-called limited geography theory. If there are any Lamanites remaining, they are probably the descendants of the Mayan peoples of Mesoamerica. And the rest of the hemisphere the rest of the aboriginal peoples in the hemisphere are not Lamanites, never were Lamanites, never will be Lamanites. And so you're just kidding yourself if you think that by going off and studying aboriginal peoples in different parts of the hemisphere, you're going to find proof or disproof about anybody being Lamanite about any connection with the Book of Mormon. That rather more conservative understanding of the geographical setting of the Lamanites has its strengths, of course, because it means that there's a lot less to take on in the world of scholarship. But what's fascinating to me is that this is not at all what the prophet Joseph thought about who the Lamanites were. It's unquestionable that Joseph Smith believed and knew in his heart of hearts that the Lamanites were those people on the plains, the American plains. And that's why Zion was established on the borders by the Lamanites. And what we have seen with the passage of time, because of one disappointment after another, one day of the Lamanites after another, that gives you a little light in the eastern sky, but the sun never quite comes up. You know, one after another, of disappointments has brought the conventional LDS understanding among people who care at all to the position that we now identify Lamanites as the people of Mesoamerica. So, who are the Lamanites really? How did they get to be Lamanites? It's an interesting study of, first of all, how a people like the Latter-day Saints develop and acquire and construct an identity for themselves as literal descendants of Ephraim, and then undertake to construct identities for other peoples that are important in the divine scheme of things, like Lamanites. But, of course, this identity construction has occurred in different stages and has been applied to different peoples at different stages of LDS history, so that now it applies to the Mesoamerican Aboriginal peoples. And how did that happen? Well, the most fascinating thing to me about it is that it happened without any direction from general authorities at all. There's no revelation about this. There's no official statement about who the Lamanites are. There are a lot of early statements from Joseph Smith and his colleagues about who they thought the Lamanites were, but those have not been revived in at least since the middle of the 20th century. And the de facto operational power to define who the Lamanites are has been left in the hands of BYU scholars, and in particular the Farms people. And this isn't to say there isn't any official backing for this, because there is. John Sorensen's 1985 book, which really kind of wraps this up, was preceded by two long Ensign articles in 1984, in which he laid out the same basic thesis. So there are some brethren up there that think this is a good idea, but nobody from the church leadership is saying this is where we say the Lamanites are, and nobody's claiming any revelation about it, nobody's claiming anything official about it. So it's an interesting study in what you might call doctrinal drift. And not the only example that we could find in the history of the church. I think I'll end there, as usual, a little longer than I thought. But Tom, have at it.
What do those people who are called Lamanites conceive of that identity to be? That is, he takes some time to I'm honored to be able to respond to Armin Moss. I have always admired his work, and he's been an inspiration to me in my research along the lines of particularly Native Americans and Mormons. So it's a great honor for me to have this privilege. I'd first like to make just a few general comments about his book, All Abraham's Children. I think it's a seminal contribution to Mormon understandings of ethnicity and ethnic relations. And in that respect, highly recommend it. It makes some significant contributions, some of which he's outlined, and I'm going to illustrate a few other things it does that I think are also important that didn't get as much attention in his comments today, but they're lines of thought that I think are also important from the book, but ones that are worth developing, perhaps Armand in some of his future work or other scholars, and of course including some of the contributions I hope to make to the larger field that follow this line. Well, first, just about a few things on the book. One of the real strengths is the looking at the cultural and social construction of identity, the way that in a sense, the way I like to put it to my students is in anthropology is culture is that part of life that we invent, that we as humans invent, but we often forget our role in the process. Okay, and that we're very, in order to enhance our own positions of authority, we're coming from nature, or they are coming from God, or giving them this status that enhances their authority, but forgetting our role in the process. And one of the real strengths of Armand's book is that without denigrating people's beliefs, he looks very carefully at the human role in the process of constructions of identity within the church. And that is a valuable contribution that needs to be taken seriously, because if we are the inventors of these identities, we can and we have the power to shape them and change them or drift them, as Armand has shown. We have that ability to adapt them to new circumstances. Another general contribution that his book makes is a look at the relationships between federal Indian policies towards Native Americans, and how they coalesce with, intersect with, and affect, and I would say also are affected by Mormon conceptions about Indians. In fact, that's one area that I think there is some future work to be done on, particularly in the 20th century, is the degree to which Mormons actually helped shape federal Indian policies, particularly during the 1950s, with the influence of Senator Watkins from Utah, helped to shape federal Indian policies towards Indians. And that gets some attention in the book. It's an area that there needs to be more exploration. And another aspect that he didn't mention so much today, but that I really admire about the book, is that in contrast to, let's say, the work that's coming from farms, Armand takes the time to at least focus some attention on what do those people who are called Lamanites conceive of that identity to be. That is, he takes some time to look at how are the so-called Lamanites conceiving of their own, or constructing their own identities. And that's an element that has been largely missing in Mormon scholarship. One again that Armand didn't mention, but I want to highlight, is there in the text, and is one worth exploring to a further degree. And another one that he addresses is an element of the cultural differences that exist between Native Americans and Mormons. And of course, with Native Americans, you're dealing with lots of different cultures. You're not dealing with a single culture, and I would argue even with Mormonism, you're also dealing with lots of different cultures within a larger institution. Well, I'm going to give an illustration of the importance of that in relationship to one of the topics that Armand talked about, and that's the concept of conversion. That I think one of the reasons that Mormons, especially in the 19th century as well as in the 20th century, were disappointed with the conversions of Indians is because they had different conceptions of what constituted conversion. The Book of Mormon lays out a model of conversion, and that model of conversion is rather significant cultural and social changes in a person's life, and sometimes even marked by biological references. That is, the Lamanites, when they converted to Christianity, not only did they change their religion, they changed their subsistence patterns. Okay, they went from hunters and gatherers to agriculturalists. They changed their locations. They often moved from one location to another. They changed. It was a wholesale cultural change that in the Book of Mormon was marked also by biological changes, and that is that they became white. Now, this conception, as Armand points out, was very similar to U.S. federal Indian policies. You know, if you've got that model of conversion, and that's how you're going to measure the success of your converts, you're going to be sorely disappointed no matter who you're trying to convert. Okay? Because people don't abandon their culture. People adapt their cultures, they change their cultures, but they don't abandon it on a wholesale scale. And certainly Native Americans who were baptized had some different conceptions of what that meant. And I'm going to give a few historical examples. One that was eye-opening to me when I was doing ethnographic fieldwork in Guatemala. And I was interviewing at the time I was also going to a language school, and I was doing research. I told my instructors that I wanted to do this research on Mormons, and my instructor said, "Well, I've got a relative, my uncle, he's a Mormon." And I said, "Well, great, I would like to meet him." Well, I went to church and I never saw him. This uncle of hers was never at church. I asked about him, and they said, "Oh yeah, he used to be in the bishopric, but he's inactive." So through my instructor, my language instructor, I got in connection with this, I'll call this guy, Hermano Satillo. And we went to visit him in his home, and I asked him, my language instructor had always emphasized his Mormon identity. And somewhat naively, I had assumed, like the people at church, that he no longer really identified himself as Mormon because he didn't come to church. And I asked a question along that line of, why aren't you going to church? And he was very, very quick to say, "I am a Mormon. So I'm proud of what I do as a Mormon." He says, I don't drink. I don't smoke. I work. In fact, as a result of converting, I've been able to buy this new pickup truck, and because of this new pickup truck that I have, I'm working a lot on Sundays, and so I can't go to church. But I'm very much a Mormon. Okay? And he really strongly emphasized that he was a Mormon. He became a Mormon for utilitarian purposes. It advanced his economic standing. It provided him, got him out of an alcohol problem. And provided him an opportunity to build his business enterprises. So his conception of being a Mormon, he was very much a Mormon, but he wouldn't meet the cost-benefit analysis of a good convert. Another example from historical would be Black Hawk and Wakara in the 19th century in Utah. Both Black Hawk and Wakara were Mormon converts, baptized Mormons, yet they were also the biggest military rivals facing the Mormons in the 19th century Utah. Okay? Yet they were baptized Mormons. Now, I think there's more historical research needs to be looked into what it is that they thought that meant. Okay? How did they conceive of being Mormon? And did they ever abandon that identity, or did they maintain it throughout their lives? Another one is Navajo Ashley. And I have just a little bit about him. Navajo Ashley is known as the one who greets with deep respect, and was known to the predominantly Mormon people of Blanding, Utah, as Navajo Ashley. And praised as an example of the best from the Indian's world in white man's eyes. He was interviewed in 1978 while approximately 80 to 90 years old. And Ashley had, according to Robert McPherson, had superficially accepted the outer trappings of the white man's world, but had remained less obviously rooted in his experiences as a member of the most prominent Navajo clan, the Bitterwater people. He was baptized in the LDS Church on the 23rd of September 1960 and embraced Mormonism, but never fully abandoned many traditional Navajo beliefs, such as the existence of the gods and their involvement in his daily activities, the power of witchcraft as a force to be reckoned with, and the central importance of his family. Ashley believed Mormonism tied in with the stories of the old folk. And while acknowledging the suspicion of other Indians, he explained his participation in Mormon Christianity in these terms. He says, "Some people do not like the Christian beliefs. I go to church with them, and they tell me about it and explain the things pretty well. What I have observed about the Christians is that they are well-behaved and speak good words. Their prayers are true, too. The Christian people are helpful. When they see you, when they say you need help, they help you. And with this, life is a little better. They taught us a way of life, and what they say tells of a good way to live. I wondered where they came from to be so nice and kind with their help and words. They gave us food. I just wondered how they could be so wonderful. I'm talking about the people in Blanding. They are the Christian Mormons." And in Navajo Ashley's experience, you see a different conception of what it means to be a Mormon. And he was an irregular attender of church, but he went on occasion. There's also, of course, George P. Lee is another example of someone that might, on one hand, fits that model of a convert who not only benefited from the Mormon Indian Placement Program, but also economically in his career, becoming the first PhD, American Indian PhD from BYU. Yet in his case, he would experience a sense of betrayal, particularly with these changes that Arm is talking about in terms of what is a Lamanite. And in his autobiography, he says, "Looking back, I am amazed I had such an opportunity," and he's referring to the placement program. He says, "There I was, a little skinny, ragged Navajo boy, fresh off the reservation, immersed in Indian traditions and superstitions, and coming from circumstances that demanded a constant struggle to survive. Subconsciously, I was still aware that I was an Indian, and that I still had an Indian family back home on the reservation. I often took time to think about my natural family, especially on the rare occasions when I received a letter from them. It did not take me long to learn that the more I thought about the reservation, the more lonely and homesick I became. I then made up my mind that I was going to take the best of what was offered, and I was going to keep my mind on activities with my foster family." And, of course, as I said, he went on to a rather successful career in the church and in education until the late 1980s. And following the death of Spencer W. Kimball in 1985. And these are some selections he wrote from his famous letters that some of you may have seen reprinted at Sunstone and elsewhere. And here's where he confronts this changing conception of identity. He says, "You have taught that the Book of Mormon is not written to the Lamanites, but to the Gentiles in our day. You have come very close to denying the Book of Mormon is about Lamanites. You have cut out Indian or Lamanite programs and are attempting to cut them out of the Book of Mormon. You're trying to discredit or downplay the role of Lamanites in these last days and downplay their role in the importance of building up of the New Jerusalem. You are teaching members to teach from the Book of Mormon and at the same time downplay their role in the Book of Mormon. You're teaching that today's Lamanites are descendants of wicked, evil Lamanites in the Book of Mormon. The truth is, the Lamanites today are descendants of both Nephites and Lamanites. Therefore, they carry the blood of Mormon, Moroni, Nephi, Lehi, and other great Book of Mormon prophets in their veins today. You are loving the Indians and other Lamanites at a distance, and you have no sense of responsibility to them because you displaced them and set yourself up as Ephraim, more superior to the Lamanites. And thus you are telling the Lamanites that you are number one, and they are second class. You're trying to take their place in the divine roles and assignments. You're slowly causing a spiritual slaughter of the Indians and other Lamanites. In George P. Lee's experience, here's a person that exemplified that model of what Mormons wanted in terms of conversion. Yet he felt, as these identity shifted, a sense of betrayal, a sense of the abandonment of the Indian programs, a sense, it somewhat expressed here, but I've heard from other sources, that this new farms model of the Book of Mormon was at least used as a means to justify this abandonment of the Indian programs and the abandonment of attention to the Indians in North America. And so what I would like to emphasize as I bring my comments to a close is that one of the strengths of Armin's work is that he's directed some of the attention to not only the constructions of identity by white Mormons about ethnic minorities, but he's also devoted some attention to the experience of the ethnic minorities within the church. I would like to foster and encourage more of that type of attention. And I don't think that the issues are going to get any easier in the near future as new evidence, not only archaeological but genetic, raises serious problems with current conceptions of Lamanites, even in Mesoamerica.
Well, thank you for Armin and Tom, their comments. We'll entertain questions. Let me make one question first to Armin. You mentioned that concept that the Lamanites, the Book of Mormon, are limited to that Mesoamerican area between southern Mexico and northern Guatemala came out with John Sorensen. I thought that Tom Ferguson and Milton R. Hunter presented that same idea 20 years earlier. Is that, am I remembering wrong?
Yes, I think Ferguson and Hunter had a limited geography model, but I don't think they had identified the precise location in the way that Sorensen did. The most I don't remember now where Ferguson, in the 1940s, Ferguson published this book called Camorra Where? And I remember it was a great scandal at the time because the book argued that whatever Joseph Smith called a Hill Camorra was not what the early Book of Mormon people called the Hill Camorra, and that it was located down there in Mexico. I thought he said in Mexico, as I recall, but it's been a long time since I've seen that book. Now, I should have made clear that Farms, John Sorensen and Farms, were not the first people to identify South America or Central America or even Mexico as Lamanite. Even the prophet Joseph, during his lifetime, began to get stories that came from explorers who went down into Mexico. And he would find these written up in local newspapers. And you can see in the Times and Seasons of Nauvoo a couple of articles in which Joseph Smith or John Taylor or whoever was editor at the time would call the attention of the Nauvoo Saints to these discoveries in Latin America, and they would go on to say, so these are probably Lamanites too, was their sort of idea. They began to expand, even during the prophet's lifetime, out of North American Aboriginal peoples into Latin America. And there was this wonderful expedition around the turn of the century by the president of BYU, Clough, who sent an expedition down to find Zarahemla, and it was a terrible debacle. That's a long story. Sam Taylor has this wonderful account of it in his book, Rocky Mountain Saints. So it's not something that began with John Sorensen. But I guess the way I would characterize it is that with the passage of time, during from Clough at least, on down to Sorensen, there has been a gradual narrowing of the geography of the Book of Mormon. That's what's remarkable to me. Not that Sorensen was new in identifying Latin America someplace as where the Book of Mormon took place, but that he became so precise about it. Is that about what you would say?
The first person I know of that, and this is according to John Sorensen, that proposed the limited geography was Lewis Hills, an RLDS scholar.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't know.
At least that's what John Sorensen in his source book says. So that goes really back to the early 20th century.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it was Sorensen though that really fleshed it out. If you know his book, it's as though Sorensen got a hold of a big transparency and sketched out on that transparency all he could figure out on a kind of ideal type basis. That is, from what the Book of Mormon says about where the mountains were and where the rivers were and how many days' journey it was from this place to that place, you know, what would the geography of the Book of Mormon look like? It's kind of basically in the abstract, but as concrete as we could make it with the information we have. And he sketches that out on a transparency, which he then moves around on a map of the Western Hemisphere until he comes to the place where it fits the best. And that is this area of southern Mexico and Guatemala. Now, I hasten to add that as far as I know, Sorensen never did anything with a transparency. I'm saying it's as though he had laid it out first on a transparency and then tried to find out where it would fit the best, and then he finally makes the arguments that he thinks support that best fit. And I think he was new in trying to be that precise. Okay, Phil?
You were talking about the Indian placement and its demise, but I can remember during the 60s and 70s when I was participating in that program, how many newspaper articles there were against the church practicing so-called cultural genocide.
Sure.
Wasn't that another big factor in the way that ended? And is that mentioned in your book?
Yeah, I go into that to some extent in my book, too. I would put that in the 70s, not in the 60s.
Yeah, it was in the 70s.
There's no doubt that basically what happened was that by the 1970s, the native peoples themselves began to get their act together. And began to understand how you use the American political system the way other groups had done. And so that was one of the things that came out of that period was a kind of a backlash from the native peoples themselves. And that was one of the charges that this is cultural genocide. You know, we're purging these people of their culture. From their point of view, I think that's a perfectly valid position to take. But it's also the case that not all native peoples, either as individuals or as tribes, felt the same way about this. Some were just more than eager to get assimilated. Others were not at all eager to get assimilated. It's hazardous to make a lot of generalizations.
We come up and answer the question on the phone. I've never been in the mic. Go, you're on.
I'm loud. I can say it again. You were very good in laying out the timeline there of Joseph Smith, the 19th century, 20th century. But what about the future? Do you comment on your book about the future? Because we've all been raised in the church with the teachings that future worldview.
Yeah.
Can you comment on that?
The question is about given what I've said about tracing the chronology so far, what would I say about the future? I wait with interest the future developments. I fully expect that the Lamanite identity will be revised still again. I expect that to happen. One of the things one of the underlying themes of my book is that all of these changes about who is and isn't of Israelite identity really occurred in a dialectical relationship with what the missionaries were discovering. That it was the church's missionary program that has really run up against all of these different definitions of identity and finding, no evidence of the blood of Israel in some places where it was supposed to be, like the tribal peoples of North America. If believing blood is what we're out to find, which was an old idea. But on the other hand, finding all kinds of people joining the church in the most unlikely places. I mean, why should all of those Polynesians have become such gung-ho Mormons? And it isn't, it isn't enough to mention the Hagoth story in the Book of Mormon, because that fleeting passage is the only basis that anybody has for connecting the Book of Mormon people to the Polynesian people. Not only that, but Hagoth was a Nephite, not a Lamanite. And so why did all those Polynesians join the church? Well, in a post facto explanation, we learned that they were all Lamanites, and they had believing blood. And the English joined the church in droves until about 1870, 75, and then they quit. What's his name?
Dyer?
No, I'm thinking of the counselor to the newspaper man, Cannon. Yeah. George Cannon allowed his how in a general conference that all these converts that came to Utah, that emptied out the blood of Israel from and that's why nobody joins the church anymore in the British Isles. So you have this interaction between this missionary success or lack of same and defining who is an Israelite and who isn't. It's real interesting.
Probably the most successful place in the world now for ease of conversion is in Africa. How are we going to assimilate that?
That's really, yeah. Well, that's a wonderful example. And it's that sort of thing that provides, I think, a real prospect for an eventual total reversal of our understanding of what the identity of Africans really is. I don't expect to live to see it, but I think Tom will live to see the time that we'll hear people teaching that the blood of Israel entered Africa, especially northwestern Africa, sub-Saharan northwestern Africa, and that we're not sure when it happened, but with all those converts, it's got to be there. So,
yes, sir. Can I make a comment on that?
Yeah.
I think Africa is a good prospect for the setting of the Book of Mormon. They've got horses, they had chariots, they had wheat, they even have the DNA of Israel.
Yeah, but they didn't ever become white.
Well, yeah. Well, that.
Actually, the website and the group that teach that.
Oh, is there? Well, that's fascinating. Do you remember what it's called?
I'll send you an email.
Oh, good. Do that.
Friend,
yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah.
I wonder if you could comment on what you think might happen with the establishment of the LDS Church and change falling away because of the cultural identity of the different black tribal people.
I'm not sure what the question is. What would
have a cultural identity interacting with church members and the expectations
You're talking about the cultural identity of the various black peoples in particular, or just or anybody?
Nigerian, oh, Madonna.
Oh, I see. Okay. The question. Oh, I see. Okay, specific cultures of
yes,
yeah.
Humble,
yeah.
Wearing white churches.
Right.
Church to church and giving
up crumbs. Right, right. Yeah, the question is how will church doctrine and practice now interact with the cultural traditions and heritages of people who join the church from these different cultures, like the Yoruba people in Africa and other peoples? And I think the answer there is pretty much the same as it would be for any culture, any place in the world. What you learn when you study how the gospel is assimilated, and the church teachings are assimilated in different cultural settings, is that the success and the growth of the church in a given setting has a lot to do with how costly church membership is to the people who live in that particular culture. I'm not talking about necessarily economic cost, but I'm talking about what they have to give up of their cultural capital in order to join the church. And that's a big problem even in Europe. You know, where Mormonism has about the same status in the public eyes as the Moonies and the Krishnas, and it is not cool to be a Mormon in most of the world outside of North America. And to the extent that you have a high cost to pay for church membership, it's unlikely to grow. So what you have to look at is whether the cost, that is, what cultural traits people have to give up, are fundamental to their identity or not. And that's the answer to that's going to vary with a number, vary with various cultures. I don't know how important it is to Africans to be able to use drums in sacrament meeting. But you're not supposed to do it yet. I think if they have to give up something fundamental, like their very identity or their understanding of the way the world works and the way nature works, then it's going to be much more difficult. Probably certain superficial things or less fundamental things can be let go. That's my usual long-winded answer. But.
Sure. I grew up in the 50s in Southern California. My bishop was a man by the name of Jack West. And he used to go around and give these lectures called The Trial of the Stick of Joseph. And I was there many, many times because he was my bishop. And he would draw thousands. I mean, we would fill our buildings with overflow, all the way back to the stage kind of thing where, you know, the state centers would be filled. And he'd do this over and over and over again. And so I sat through them many times because he used to use me as one of his samplers. I played Joseph Smith in his play once. And I've never heard him brought up in any intellectual conversation about the story of the Book of Mormon. I'm curious to know if you've ever encountered him or what your opinion of his work was or whatever.
I don't think I ever encountered Jack West himself, but it seems to me I read a transcript of that presentation. Yeah,
yeah,
right. And you know, was he ever a lawyer?
Yes.
Yeah. So he tried to bring to bear, you know, the legal framework of argument for that trial.
He never really practiced as a lawyer, but he went to law school.
Oh. Well, no,
he was a building contractor.
Oh, I see. Well, I don't think I ever actually heard the presentation, but I remember being impressed when I read it, when I read the transcript of it, because I was kind of young and innocent too at the time. But not
as much as I was.
Yeah. Yes.
So kind of back to the question we were talking about before. Tom might be able to comment on this as well as Armin, but with assimilation that occurs in the country in general through the political and how the religions kind of jumped onto that and participated in that, what is your feeling as far as Africa, and I know Tom can speak to Latin America, in that it seems to me that the church has the most success with people who have already been colonized or already been assimilated, and so perhaps they have already given up a considerable amount of what they would have held on as cultural baggage. And when you get to Polynesia, in that area, has the church begun to learn a little bit and maybe allow a little bit more retention of cultural identities? Because my understanding is that the island, it is much more culturally integrated and what is allowed and what
right.
would be acceptable.
It's a little looser, right.
Yeah.
The question is, conversion to Mormonism is more likely among peoples who have already made a degree of conversion by already becoming Christians of some other kind or some. Yeah, that's certainly the case in not only in Africa but in Asia. I know from my studies of Asians too that if someone has already adopted another Christian faith, the chances are greatly enhanced that the person can be converted to Mormonism, because that, as you put it, they've already gone part of the distance. And that's one of the reasons that church membership has grown so fast and remains so active in Korea, because a third at least of Koreans were already Christians. The Presbyterians, I think, got there early and did a good job, and the Mormons came along, and of course, yeah, this is known as sheep stealing, you understand. So that's right. Did you want to speak further on that?
I can add that that's basically the same sort of thing you get in Latin America. That is, that conversion in Latin America is not the rural, nominally Catholic Mormons, but for the most part, it's people in the city.
But it's also not the indigenous people.
Yeah, it's not so much. It was people of indigenous descent, but in the cities that have been urbanized, that have been a little more involved in Catholicism and often in Protestantism. For example, in Osumba, in central Mexico, where the first branch of the church was established in the late 19th century, that area was a hotbed of Protestant proselytization, and it's where Mormonism got its start in central Mexico. So not only the Catholic, not only being a Christian in terms of being a Catholic, but also being a Protestant, I think, is another assistance in terms of the cultural capital. And although my sample in Guatemala, which of course you know well because you were there, was small, that there was a striking number of former Protestants among the Mormons in the ward we were working in. There were more former Protestants within the church than a percentage of the population.
If I remember correctly, the fastest growing group in Latin America is not Mormons but Pentecostals. But I think there's a lot of passage circulating around among Mormons, Pentecostals, and Jehovah's Witnesses.
And I can add, when I was in Guatemala, I went through and counted all the Protestant and Catholic claims of numbers of how many people were members of their church, and it was something like 150% of the population. So there's had to be some moving around.
Well, it's time to quit so we can go to lunch. Thank you very much for your presentation. When were you in Guatemala?
In 1993.